Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 13 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us of today's topic.
Today we're going to be talking about meteor showers and with regard to what they are, where they are, and why they are. But first, as is our custom, let's talk about an update.
Well, Tim, I'm pleased to report of a timely new study published in Sweden by planetary scientist Dr. Mikhail Gravnik of the Luleå University of Technology. He postulates that Earth's intense gravity rips incoming asteroids apart, reducing their risk of remaining whole and becoming planetary killers, a topic mentioned in our very first episode of Space Talks.
You know, that sounds kind of counterintuitive. You'd think that gravity would attract an asteroid and therefore make the impact here more probable, but not less.
I agree, Tim. And admittedly, it's rather a moot point in that, yes, the Earth will attract an asteroid, but we mustn't forget how fortunate we are to have the Earth-Moon gravitational lock on our side. Now, just in case listeners don't know that, let's go into that a bit. Just as the Moon influences tides on Earth, so too the Earth influences tides on the Moon. Well, it would if the Moon had any liquid water. But that point aside, the Moon is tidally locked to the Earth, and that's because the Moon is not equally balanced throughout. There are areas on the Moon more massive than others, and that more massive side always faces the Earth.
Right. So it's like a bicycle wheel then. If you turn the bike upside down, and the front wheel in particular can spin freely, you can actually demonstrate tidal locking. Simply add a weight, such as, say, a hunk of sticky mud to any part of the wheel, spin it, and the part of the wheel with that heavy mud is always going to come to rest at the bottom facing toward the Earth.
So strong mutual gravitational forces exist in the space between the Earth and the Moon. And Dr. Gravnik postulates that force can rip apart asteroids. Drawing upon the 1994 Shoemaker-Levy comet, which was torn apart by Jupiter's tidal forces before crashing into the gas giant, astronomers searched for but couldn't find evidence that Earth did tidally disrupt passing asteroids or comets. And so the hunt for those gravitationally torn asteroids remained at a dead end for about 20 years until 2016, when Gravnik had an inspiration. Using 7 years' worth of actual asteroid and near-Earth objects, he assisted in creating a computer model which calculated those trajectories, and it was determined that NEOs lose between 50 to 90% of their mass due to Earth's tidal forces. And so, just as the Sun's magnetosphere protects Earth from certain cosmic radiation, the Earth's gravity helps protect us from asteroid impacts.
And a darn good thing, too. It's a timely update as well, Steve, because today's topic, we're going to be talking about meteor showers, and we're going to be drilling pretty deep into this topic. But before we get into the meteor parts, I thought I'd share a few fun facts to get us started. So for starters, those streaks of light made by a meteoroid enter our atmosphere are a whole lot smaller than you might imagine, given the amount of light that they generate. Typically, they range in size from a grain of sand to a pebble, or if you will, a fraction of a millimeter to a couple of millimeters. So although some meteor showers are the result of asteroids, mostly comets are the cause of the meteor showers that we all know. And the reason meteor showers are brightest after midnight? Well, that's the side of the planet Earth that's heading into the field of debris, the side of our planet decidedly not facing the sun. It's in the early morning hours that you are essentially driving the planet into that stream of meteoroids, and therefore increasing the chances of seeing more of them. Now, before science caught up with the speculation that we all had centuries ago, past civilizations have viewed meteors as the souls of the dead, It's become part of creation stories for First Nations. And certainly in European cultures, it's an ominous sign of bad things to come. Steve, you're going to set us straight, though, on the naming protocols, just what is and is not a meteor.
Well, I do know that a lot of car companies in the 1950s and 60s used astronomical phenomenon to define their products because society at that time was moving into the jet and the rocket age. And in no particular order, there were vehicles such as the Galaxy, the Windstar, Nova, Taurus, Comet, Equinox, Vega, Aerostar, the Rocket 88 engine by Oldsmobile, Saturn, Pulsar, Starchief, Polara, Aries, and last but not least, the Meteor.
I think about how many of those brands I owned, and it's more than one. There may not be any of the roadbound meteors anymore, but there's lots in space. So how about sorting out the difference between meteoroids and meteorites?
Way back in the 1950s, there was a novelty song called The Name Game, which took someone's name and added different comical endings to it. That same sort of thing happens to meteoroids, which, as you mentioned, are tiny pebbles or grainy particles in space. But when they enter the Earth's atmosphere and burn brightly, they become known as meteors. And surviving fragments, which reach the Earth's surface, are called meteorites. So the order from top to bottom are meteoroids become meteors, and they then become meteorites.
And there are three types of near-Earth objects, and those are comets, asteroids, and meteoroids.
Okay, so Tim, what's the difference between these three types of NEOs?
Right. Well, comets are composed of ice and rock. Asteroids, however, are composed of rock and metal. And meteoroids are actually just smaller than asteroids. And all three are traveling through space on gravitationally determined pathways. And all three may come close to the Earth. And it should be noted that any object traveling at speed will heat up when it enters our atmosphere due to friction. And if the speed is sufficient, it will heat up sufficiently to glow and burn.
Well, Tim, at this point, let's have a listen to an expert talk about the differences between a comet, an asteroid, and a meteor. I've scoured the internet like I usually do and managed to find a conversation by the Dutch-born meteor shower expert, Dr. Peter Jenenskens, who is a senior research scientist at the Carl Sagan Center of the SETI Institute. Let's have a listen.
The comet is the object that is in space and that travels around the sun. That's what we call a comet. It contains volatiles and stuff that easily evaporates and sublimates. And so when the object comes closer to the sun, then those ices sublimate and they carry along dust particles and that sort of make them fuzzy looking. So for astronomers, comets are things that are fuzzy. Usually they are about a kilometer in size. Comets don't tend to come small. They sort of start at, a few hundred meters and then up. And then they can be very big. I mean, Comet Hale-Bopp was like 40 kilometers in size. So they can get big chunks. But that's a comet. And the meteor is the light phenomenon. It's the shooting star you see in the sky. So the bright light that happens when a little piece of the comet comes into the atmosphere. Did it come from a comet or did it actually come from an asteroid? If it came from an asteroid, then its origin was somewhere in the asteroid belt, most likely. And in that case, it was stronger material, more stony or iron-like. And in that case, if it comes in slow enough, if it's big enough to start with, pieces can survive. And so, if you see one of those events, then it's worthwhile go look for it and see if you can find a piece. And it turns out that that's very difficult. So finding meteorites is a real challenge. How big of a challenge? Well, over all of the Earth, every year, we are getting about between 10 and 15 or so accounts from people having seen a meteorite fall. Usually it's because it goes to the roof of some house or somebody sees it fall close to somebody. And that number has been the same for almost all this century.
We've all become familiar with heat shields on spacecraft. And when they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, they're moving at about 28,000 kilometers per hour. Now that's fast, but by comparison, when a meteoroid enters the Earth's atmosphere, its typical speed is about 48,000 kilometers, but they can be as fast as 257,000 kilometers per hour. And the subsequent friction causes it to heat up to 1600 degrees Celsius or more. This, of course, causes it to burn and become mislabeled as shooting stars. They're not stars at all. Since the average size of a meteoroid is about the size of a pebble, they burn up very quickly, typically lasting only a second or two. But there's no denying how bright they are. Oh, and here's an interesting fact, Tim. Since these meteoroids are so small and their lives so short, they typically burn up at altitudes of about 100 kilometers up in the sky. So if you see it, your friend who lives about 200 kilometers away likely won't.
You're talking about the curvature of the Earth here. So we know that these small pebble-sized meteorites are traveling at speed and burn up and glow in the atmosphere because of friction becoming meteors. So now let's talk about meteor showers. Here's the question. At what point are there enough meteors seen for the event to be called a meteor shower? Steve, what's the answer?
Well, it's probably a abstract one, but both you and I have seen many meteors, and virtually anybody can see one any clear night, assuming that they're not standing in an urban center under a streetlight. On a clear, dark night, it usually doesn't take more than about 20 minutes to see a meteor. And of course, this happens during the day as well, but the ambient brightness from the sun is such that you can't see it.
You know, Steve, you couldn't blame anyone for thinking that given the size of these meteors and how small they are and the incredible temperatures that they're going to be going through, that at the end of that burnout, there'd be nothing left. But in fact, that's not the case, and not by a long shot. There is ash, and that ash does in fact drift its way down to the ground.
When I first learned of this, I was astounded. Meteor dust, also known as cosmic dust or micrometeoroids, constantly enters our atmosphere. Now, researchers using Doppler LiDAR, which is an instrument measuring changes in the composition of the atmosphere, calculate the amount of cosmic dust falling to the Earth each day is about 60 tons. Now, surprisingly, this cosmic dust or meteoroid dust is helpful to the environment, not only in helping build up clouds in the atmosphere, but also helping to fertilize plankton in the region around the Antarctica.
I'm going to be a bit more romantic about this. You've called it cosmic dust, but you know, it's equally fair to call that 60 tons stardust. The asteroids and comets themselves were made up in part from elements derived from distant stars or other celestial objects. So think about it, 60 tons a day. And we're talking about mostly tiny particles or pebbles worth of material. However, astronomers currently say that there's some 112 periodic meteor showers that can generate that much tonnage. It's amazing what little I did know about this.
And that was news to me as well, Tim. Now, I did know of the Perseids as well as the Geminids, but 110 others for a total of 112? That's really amazing. What I did know, however, was that some of the meteor showers are more prolific than others, with the Perseids topping out at about 100 possible shooting stars visible in an hour.
So what we're talking about here is the rate of meteors during a meteor shower, and that's called ZHR, or zenithal hourly rate. Of those 112 meteor showers we mentioned, a great many are visible from British Columbia. For instance, the Quadrantids in January have a high ZHR of 120, as opposed to the Leonids in November having a lower rate of 15.
In my early years of stargazing, Tim, I quickly realized that meteor showers were named after the constellation from which they appear to streak from across the sky. Therefore, the aforementioned Perseids seem to come from the constellation Perseus, and the Leonids from the constellation Leo. To add a little bit of class to the nomenclature, the Latin possessive form of ids as a suffix is added, and so a shower appearing to emanate from the Draco constellation is called the Draconids.
Well, under perfect viewing conditions, the streaks may appear to be coming from a single spot in the constellation that you mentioned, flaring out in all directions. But in fact, that's an optical illusion, as the small meteorites are in fact all traveling along a parallel path and aren't shooting out like a spray of water from a hose.
And that parallax illusion is similar to looking down a long stretch of train tracks. You know they remain parallel until you can't see them, and yet to your eye, they appear to converge to a single spot. Tim, let's have a listen to what the aforementioned Dr. Yenenskens has to say about meteor showers.
There was a meteor shower active that night when you were out. I don't know if that was happened to be in August when the Perseids are there, or December when the Geminids are there. But there are actually many meteor showers every night. If this happens to you again, you see a meteor like that, and you sort of trace it on the sky between the stars, and you get, then backward tracking it backwards should take you to the radiant. And so you see that all the meteors are coming from one point in the sky, which is called the radiant. And that's the direction from which these things are coming towards us. So you're standing sort of in the middle of it. And so that's the direction from which the things are coming. If you now go on the CAMS website and you go to our visualization tool, then you can see which meteor showers are active.
At the end of that sound clip, listeners may have caught the good doctor referring to the CAMS website, which he helped found. CAMS is the acronym for Cameras for All Sky Meteor Surveillance Project. This is a NASA-sponsored international project which tracks and triangulates meteors during nighttime video surveillance in order to map and monitor meteor showers.
And what I find interesting about meteor showers is their origin. There's a bit of deja vu all over again in this story, if you will. Perhaps we could say Groundhog Day. Every year, planet Earth ends up plowing through the same debris fields.
Well, Tim, we have our friends the comets to thank for that. As a comet approaches the sun, it heats up and begins to vaporize, creating a long stream of particles which follow along in spectacular tails. And we're talking about astronomically large numbers here.
We are indeed. Now, the core of most comets is less than 30 kilometers across. However, those heated streams of released dust and gas form a huge and thin atmosphere around the comet, which is called the coma. And it's about 15 times the size of the Earth. The solar wind then pushes this coma into an extremely long, glowing tail, which can exceed 450 million kilometers in length. And by comparison, the moon is a little under 400,000 kilometers away from planet Earth. So that's the size and makeup of a typical comet. But they're, in fact, usually sorted out by astronomers in a different way, according to the time they take to travel around the sun. Not surprisingly, it's known as either the long period or short period comet.
And those comets usually have a highly eccentric elliptical orbit, and they have a wide range of orbital periods, as you mentioned, ranging from several years to potentially several millions of years. Those short-range comets that you talked about originate in the Kuiper Belt, or its associated scattered disk, which lies beyond the orbit of Neptune. Long-period comets are thought to originate in the Oort cloud, which lies beyond the Kuiper Belt to halfway to the nearest star. These long-period comets are set in motion towards the sun by gravitational perturbations from passing stars and from our galaxy itself. And each time a comet swings by the sun in its orbit, some of its ice vaporizes and a certain number of meteoroids will be shed.
All right, comets then enter our solar system, scoot around the sun in some sort of path, and leave behind that trail of small, non-glowing meteoroids. And going back to our train analogy, the comet leaves behind a track of small rocks in an oval shape, just like a train layout on your living room floor. So with some frequency, the Earth passes through this path of meteoroids. Some enter our atmosphere and, of course, burn up as meteors, and larger ones may, in fact, hit the ground and become meteorites. Now that we know what they are, let's examine some of the regularly occurring ones more closely, starting with the January Quadrantids, whose name at first blush seems obscure, as I'd never heard of that before. I haven't even heard of the constellation.
I haven't either, Tim. But way back in 1795, French astronomer Jérôme Lalande created the Quadrant constellation, which included portions of the Boötes and Draco constellation.
So wait a minute here. Let's just hold that phone. The nugget in what you've just said there is that this fellow, Lalande, made the case for a different constellation of stars by giving it a name and dismissing the other constellations, if you will, that were in the same neighborhood.
Jérôme Lalande was a superbly educated French astronomer, not some guy who drove a turnip truck, and his tables of planetary positions were considered the best available until the end of the 18th century. And he devoted himself to the improvement of planetary theory and helped organize international collaborations in observing the transits of Venus in 1761 and 1769. And so a few years later in 1795, when he realigned the patterns of Draco and Boötes, the scientific community listened to him.
Let's not dive too far into the weeds here, because that constellation, the Quadrants constellation, it doesn't exist now. So, Steve, what happened to it?
Well, it seems that in 1922, the International Astronomical Union devised a modern list of 88 constellations, which didn't include it. But the meteor shower still retains its name, the Quadrantids.
Mystery solved. And I've read that this meteor shower has a relatively low ZHR of 82 back in 2008 and peaked at 315 in the year 2014, indicating that the number of shooting stars is in fact variable, and it depends upon the intersecting train of meteoroids, but also the viewing conditions afforded by the phase of the moon and any overhead clouds.
So the Quadrantids cover the month of January, Tim. The next reasonably good meteor shower is in April with the Lyrids, with a ZHR of 20, putting it on a rather sedate but still reasonable show. The summer months of June, July, and August presents us with the Boötids, Pegasids, and Perseids.
In October, it brings us the Orionids, in November the Leonids, and the Geminids in December. Now, recently, the previously mentioned Dr. Jenniskens has deemed that most of our short-period meteor showers are not from the normal water vapor drag of active comets, but in fact are the product of infrequent disintegrations. That would be large chunks breaking off what would otherwise be a mostly dormant comet.
For example, he postulates that the Quadrantids and Geminids originated from a breakup of two asteroid-looking objects between 500 and 1,000 years ago. And Tim, let's have a listen to Dr. Jenniskens talking about the Geminids and how he believes they derived their existence from an asteroid.
Yeah, the Geminids are caused by a very interesting asteroid called 3200 Triton. And the Japanese are now working on a mission project where they want to send a satellite to this particular asteroid because it is causing all these meteors on Earth. And it looks, it's a really interesting object because most of our meteor showers come from comets, but this one seems to come from an asteroid, but with a very frail sort of, and you can see that in the shooting stars because often with other meteors, you see lots of flares, you know, at the end of the track, you see a flash, but the Geminids don't do that. They are stronger. So they move very, very, they glide through the sky, if you like, rather than, you know, having flashes and flares and being very irregular. So the Geminids is very interesting meteor shower.
And so, as we do so often on this program, Tim, we repeat that phrase, the more I know, the less I know. But what you and I already know is that using an optical instrument to detect meteors is virtually useless because they move so quickly across the sky and binoculars' field of vision is so narrow. Now, if you did spot a meteor, by the time you raised your binoculars up for a closer view, it would have burned up and disintegrated. And if you do have ideal viewing conditions for a meteor shower and are nice and comfy, steadily peering through your binoculars, the chances of one flashing across the lens is exceedingly small, and if it did, you'd see a streak of light for a fraction of a second. I think your brain would cause you to wonder if indeed you did see something, or did you just imagine it?
So what we're saying is that the human eye is the best suited for casual observers, since our field of view is actually pretty good, 90 degrees vertically and 180 degrees horizontally. You can see a lot of sky without moving your head. Now, if, however, you're not willing to stand outside on a chilly night in the pre-dawn hours, patiently looking up at the sky, perhaps you could use a camera with a long exposure setting. You could set the camera up on a tripod, point it in the right direction, open the shutter, head indoors, have a cup of coffee, and wait for a few hours.
Of course, this would produce a still image of the static background stars appearing to have moved in a semicircle, but that's due to the Earth moving underneath the stars. If you do capture a meteor, it will appear as a bright, straight streak across the image.
But now, Steve, we haven't mentioned meteors that explode in the atmosphere, and that does happen. It's a very violent entry, and those are known as bolides. They're extremely bright meteors called fireballs, which can be as bright as the moon, especially if it explodes in the atmosphere. The most famous that I think we've come across is the 2013 Chelyabinsk meteor, which was a super bolide that entered the Earth's atmosphere over the southern Ural region in Russia. And it was caused by an approximately 18-meter diameter meteor with a mass of about 8 million kilograms, traveling at about 69,000 kilometers per hour.
And physicists have taken those particular numbers, and the light from that meteor was briefly brighter than the sun, and the subsequent blast had a total kinetic energy equivalent to 400 kilotons of TNT, which is some 30 times greater than the atomic bomb which decimated Hiroshima. If you haven't seen the Chelyabinsk bolide on YouTube, then you're missing out on something astronomically special.
I did, Stephen. It's very impressive. It turns out that it's very popular for cars in Russia to have dash cams. So in addition to other kinds of camera footage of people in classrooms or buildings being damaged, there was a lot of visual evidence of that. So yeah, you're right. That go to YouTube.
Tim, the reason that the Russians have so many dash cams is because there was such a proliferation of false accident claims, particularly by pedestrians. A car would be at a stop. A pedestrian would be walking across the crosswalk, throw himself onto the stationary vehicle and claim that the car had hit him, and then seek damages. So the dash cams were to prevent these kind of falsehoods. So that's kind of interesting.
But Steve, we've covered off a lot of material on this episode. And meteor showers, well, they put on a great show every year, and there's plenty of them to follow, as we've said, 112. And keep in mind, we're the happy recipients of 60 tons of stardust from those meteor showers every single day. But that's about all the time we have. So this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.